This is Dr. Chad Edwards, and you are listening to podcast number 55 of Against the Grain. Are you tired and fatigued? Are you frustrated with doctors because they just don't seem to listen? Do you want to fix your pain without surgery? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then we are the clinic for you. We offer prolotherapy, PRP or platelet-rich plasma therapy, and stem cell injections, IV nutritional therapies, bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, and functional medicine to get you back on track to optimal health. Call our clinic at 918-935-3636 or visit our website at www.revolutionhealth.org to schedule your appointment today.
Welcome to Against the Grain Podcast with Dr. Chad Edwards, where he challenges the status quo when it comes to medicine. We get into hot topics in the medical field with real stories from real patients to help you on your way to a healthy lifestyle. Get ready, because we're about to go against the grain.
Hello, hello. This is the super tall Marshall Morris, and I am here joined today with Dr. Chad Edwards, who believes that at least 80% of medical recommendations are complete crap, technically speaking here. And Dr. Edwards, his credentials are just incredible. He served in the U.S. Army. He is the author of Revolutionize Your Health with Customized Supplements. He's the founder of RevolutionHealth.org, board-certified family physician. Dr. Edwards, welcome to the podcast episode today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah?
How are you doing today?
You know, I shamelessly, this is kind of my confession. It's kind of like a confessional. Okay. My mom was Catholic, but, you know, this is kind of like, let's take 2 minutes, and this is the nutrition confessional.
Okay.
I've had 2 cups of coffee and 2 monsters today. How do I get off of that?
Well, first, bless you, my child. Well, the first thing to do is to just stop.
Just
don't do that.
Just don't do that.
Right.
Fair enough. So coffee, this is probably for all the listeners out there, they're probably asking, energy drinks or coffee, is one better or worse than the other?
Well, you got to figure the amount of sugar in a lot of the energy drinks. Mm. You know, I'm not a fan of a lot of artificial sweeteners. I would honestly rather have, for average, otherwise healthy physiology, I would rather have sugar than a lot of the artificial sweetener crap. We'll have a podcast. We should do that soon.
Okay, cool.
Have one of those soon. Maybe I'll go plan that this weekend and be ready for one of the upcoming ones. So I would, you know, eliminate those things. And you got to look at what else is in there. You know, as far as straight up plain coffee, not looking at, you know, dairy sensitivity or sugar or things like that, there's actually some benefit. You know, and if you listen to Dave Asprey's stuff, he talks about, he's the Bulletproof executive.
Yeah.
Great, great stuff. He's got a great podcast. He talks about life hacks and things like that. I mean, he's got some really good stuff out there. And he talks about some of the mycotoxins, some fungus stuff in coffee and the way it's grown and handled. And he's got some stuff that I don't know if this is a shameless plug. I get nothing. I've never talked with Dave.
Yeah.
I get nothing from this, but I believe in what he's doing, and he's got some good clean stuff, and he sells a good high quality coffee, and you could consider, you know, something like that without all of those mycotoxins. So definitely something to look at. And he's much more of an expert on the coffee realm than I am. Then the energy drink piece, again, watching all of the artificial junk that comes in a lot of them, I would rather have the sugar than a lot of the artificial stuff, but you have to look at how much sugar is in them. And some of those things are jam packed. Mm. I mean, you might as well just like open your mouth and pour the sugar in. It's crazy how much stuff that, and I'm not saying I never drink them, but, but there, it's got an insane amount of sugar.
Don't make a habit of it.
It's not that you drank some of those. It's that you had a total of 4 of them. And then, you know, especially like a Monster, you know, you get those big ones. And some of those things are like, you know, a 55-gallon drum. I mean, they're gigantic. Yeah. It's an enormous amount of stuff in there.
It's a lot.
And, you know, if you look at the labels, and you got to be real careful looking at those labels, and you see, oh, there's only 13 grams of sugar In one serving.
In one serving. And most are more than one serving.
Right. And some of those things are probably like 12 servings.
Oh, gosh.
You could feed a small town in Ethiopia.
This will be ongoing therapy between you and I.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. But okay. So not to derail us too much, but let's see if you can bring it around to today's hot topic.
Yeah. So in the intro, you mentioned 80% of medical recommendations being crap. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So we're going to talk about one of these. And this came across the teletype
this
week, that the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, recommended that the flu nasal spray not be used for the upcoming flu season. So to put that in perspective, for the last several years, you've had two options, and we won't go into the differences between the two options, but you've got the flu shot, which is an inactivated flu virus, inactivated influenza virus, IIV. And then you have the nasal flu mist that you spray up your nose. So there's no shot, but it's a live virus, attenuated live virus. So
what's attenuated?
That means it's altered slightly that it's not typically not pathogenic.
Okay.
So it doesn't cause disease, doesn't cause the flu. But it certainly elicits an immune response. And, you know, a lot of people would say, well, I got the flu shot and it worked. I got the flu. You know, I mean, it can happen. We've had a podcast. In fact, early on, we had a podcast on the flu. And I don't mean to rehash that, but I do want to talk about some of the stuff, some of the implications of this recommendation. So as I read this, you know, I was like, I wonder why they said that, you know, not to use it for 2016, 2017. And so I was just kind of like, why? So when I read the paper on it, and this is a quote, new data show that the nasal mist has been ineffective for the last three influenza seasons. So 2013 to 2016, it's been ineffective for those last seasons. And so they've said, well, we don't recommend it because it doesn't work. Well, that was really interesting to me because the flu shot doesn't work either. And some people may say, what? You know, what are you saying? So I wanted to just run through some of the history of the flu shot.
Sure.
And I don't remember how much of this we did before. You can certainly go back and listen to it, but I'm just going to kind of list out some of this stuff as far as the history of the flu shot. So in 1947, this was shortly after the flu shot became available, they found that the incidence of disease, flu, was no different in vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. So that started in 1947. In 1957, the vaccine had no appreciable effect on the trend of the Asian flu pandemic. By the early 1960s, routine influenza vaccination was generally adopted as a policy with very little supporting evidence. In 1964, the chief epidemiologist at the CDC, his name was Alexander Langmuir, L-A-N-G-M-U-I-R. He was their chief epidemiologist, physician, MD, and an MPH, had his master's in public health, quote, reluctantly concluded that there is little progress to be reported, and referring us to the making progress on reducing the mortality and reducing the incidence of flu. He went on to say that the severity of the epidemic of 1962 to 1963 demonstrates the failure to achieve effective control of excess mortality. So we're talking now in the 1960s. In 1964, his paper questioned whether the widespread immunization practice should be continued without better evidence to justify the major costs to the general public. In 1968, the CDC performed its first randomized double-blinded trial and, quote, despite extensive use of influenza vaccines, attainment of improved morbidity and mortality has never been demonstrated. That was in 1968 by a study done by the CDC. In 1976, swine flu appeared for the first time, or at least as a potential pandemic. And they feared that there was going to be this big pandemic and, you know, it was going to kill a bunch of people, you know, like what we saw in the 19-teens. And what they found was lower levels than expected of the flu, but there was an epidemic of paralytic Guillain-Barré syndrome in recipients of vaccine, which led to the program's cancellation. So they quit using the vaccine temporarily because of this epidemic of Guillain-Barré. So Guillain-Barré, for those of the listeners that don't know, is it's kind of like, you know, when you're getting a shot, when you're an immunization, when you're getting an immunization, you're trying to load your immune system and build antibodies so that you can fight the potential infection. And the way your immune system works, it's kind of like it, you know, I think about getting an APB out for, you know, Nissan, red Nissan pickups. And so your immune system is going to develop an antibody to all red Nissan pickups. But there are old red Nissan pickups and there's new red Nissan pickups. And so you can have kind of some cross reactivity, what we call molecular mimicry. And so basically Guillain-Barré is kind of an autoimmune disorder where you get the immunization and your body develops antibodies against itself, kind of attacks itself, and it causes paralysis. Usually that's temporary, but it's what we call an ascending paralysis. It starts low in your feet and it works its way up, and it can be so severe as to require ventilation. So put on an, you know, intubated and be on a ventilator. And, you know, the incidence of that continues. Current estimates are that it's 1 in 1 million, 2 in 1 million. So not very common, but when you consider the number of flu vaccines, in fact, there's roughly 171 million influenza vaccines that are projected to be given.
171 million?
Right. So we're looking at just under 200 cases. We're between 2 and 400 cases. I should say 2 to 350. 200 to 350 cases of potentially fatal Guillain-Barré because of the flu for something that, according to the data, has never been shown to be effective. So, this is in the 1976, they saw this epidemic of this stuff. And so this is one of the potential harms of the flu shot. In 1977, an analysis was conducted by the CDC which concluded that influenza control had been generally ineffective and that statistically valid community trials were needed. 1977. So again, we're 30 years into this and we're still not really seeing improvement. In 1995, so we're in the 90s, FDA acknowledged the ongoing paucity of randomized trials and warned about serious methodologic flaws in many existing flu vaccine studies. So we're just not getting good data and we're not getting good results on the flu shot. In 2000, into the 2000s, in the new millennium, CDC performed a placebo-controlled trial and found that vaccination, when compared to placebo, may not provide overall economic benefit in most years. CDC, in the 2000s, not seeing anything yet. In 2004, the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, recommended annual flu immunization. And that was, I just put that in as another milestone. And in 2012, a systematic review concluded recommendation to vaccinate the elderly was made without data for vaccine efficacy or effectiveness. So in other words, we're making recommendations, go get your flu shot, based on no scientific data. So the we probably need to take a break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about, we'll kind of summarize a lot of this stuff and why I think this is another one of the many loads of crap that we're fed.
We're getting into it. There's a little bit of a holy war against immunization.
Well, and I'll talk about that after the break too.
All right.
Vertical Limit Fitness constantly strives for better. Better mind, function, fitness, capacity, and community. They accomplish this through bodyweight boot camp style classes and high intensity functional fitness classes. From group classes to private training, Vertical Limit Fitness elevates your health and wellness while helping you become able to do anything and prepare you for everything that life may bring along. Call 918-409-1633 or visit their website at www.verticallimitfitness.com for more information and to sign up for a week of classes.
All right, we are back and we're talking about the flu shot, immunization, and everything that that entails. You started off talking about the nasal spray, the recommendation that the past three seasons, the nasal spray has been proven ineffective. Okay. Right. And then in the first half of the podcast, we were talking about the history of the flu shot and the studies associated with it, right, and how they were documenting that there has been no progress using the flu shot. in a decreased mortality rate or right. infection. So get us into why is this such a big deal or why is this happening?
Well, and that's a good question. And you alluded to one thing before, right before the break about immunization practice in general. Let me differentiate. There are some immunizations that I am extremely in favor of. For example, you know, I work in the emergency room and I see patients that get bitten by a dog, I had a patient the other day, got bit by a bat. You know, the mammal that flies and can't see in the middle of the dark, you know, a bat.
Blind as a bat.
Exactly.
Okay.
I was deployed with the military to Honduras in 2014, and we had one of our service members that got bit by a local dog. And so, you know, what happens with them, if you have not been vaccinated against rabies prophylactically, you are required to get rabies immune globulin. So this immune globulin against rabies, and you have to actually inject it. Like if you get bit on the hand or on the arm, you have to inject it all around that area.
Is it with a shot or with, yes. It's a liquid?
It's an injection.
Okay.
And you have to infiltrate it into the wound as much as possible. And then you give the rest of it as like a shot in the hip.
Yeah.
So that's no joke. And that stuff, why I had a patient, both the one that got bit by a bat and another one that got bit by a stray dog. It was a pit bull. And this was in the emergency room. This dog pit bull came out of the woods, literally came out of the woods, mangy, nasty looking, all that kind of good stuff. The guy saw the dog, turned to look the other way. And then when he turned to look the other way, the dog bit him in the back of the leg. And then just ran back off into the woods. So you don't have access to the animal. You can't test the animal. And, you know, with this, there was a lady that got bit by a bat in her hand. Neither one of these patients had insurance. And that rabies immune globulin was around $24,000 to give them. And so we're sitting here, you know, it's very frustrating because we have to make medical decisions not based on cost. In the emergency room.
Sure.
And that's what we're going to do. We're going to do whatever is in the best interest of that patient. Now the, you know, there's a piece of that there's never, at least not in 100 years, been a documented case of a dog giving a human rabies. So it's this relatively low risk of the person having a true contact. Now bat higher risk. But then, you know, somebody told me that, you know, this patient doesn't have insurance. And am I going to give this patient a $24,000 rabies immune globulin, knowing that this is relatively low risk? And with the reason that without question, I pulled the trigger on that and said, yep, we're going to do it, is because if you miss it, it's fatal. By the time you get symptoms, you're pretty much going to die.
I feel like we need to do an entire episode on having to make physicians having to make decisions based on insurance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's such a mental. It's stressful. I would imagine.
Sure.
And so I feel like we could get into that on one of the episodes.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it is. It's not an easy decision. You know, and I had to consciously make that decision, and I just. You know, the nurses were standing there talking to me and I said, okay, guys, do we make decisions? Do we discuss the cost with any other therapy with any of our other patients? And they're like, nope. And I said, then we're not having that discussion on this one. We're going to do what's in the best interest of the patient. We're not going to worry about the cost because if we miss it on this guy, he's dead. Mm-hmm. If he was exposed and we don't treat him, he's dead. So what's your life worth?
Right.
Even if you are on welfare and have to come up with $24,000 or something, I mean, you know, whatever it is, if you don't have $24,000 and don't have a way to get $24,000, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. But what's your life worth?
Sure.
And that's the decision that we have to make. And, you know, I'm going to embrace that. It is what it is. So the reason that I bring that up is because if you had the rabies immunization, then, for example, since I was with special operations, we had an extensive list of immunizations that we had to get. And one of them was the rabies vaccine series. And I'm actually very, very glad that I got that one. Because if I got bit by a dog in Honduras or, you know, like this guy, then I go to the emergency room and they say, okay, you've had a rabies immunization. Okay, let's give you your booster. They give me a rabies immunization and I walk out the door. That's it. Mm. The difference is one person has to pay $24,000, or their insurance has to pay $24,000 for rabies immune globulin, and they also get the immunization, versus me, I just have to get an update to my immunization.
Sure.
And the cost difference is dramatic. You know, I do travel, and some with the military and some civilian, and you know, those kinds of things. And you know, I've done mission trips and love going to Honduras. It's and so there's always the potential of exposure like that. And if I'm in a third world country and get bit by a rabid dog, what am I going to do? Mm-hmm.
Now, how does that compare to the exposure to the flu then?
So the risk of the flu is, you know, while there are fatalities to the flu virus, I'm not going to underplay that. But this is, you're talking about what are the chances of dying from the flu if you get the flu? I've never in my medical practice in my medical practice period, I personally have never seen anyone die from the flu. We know it happens. I'm not underplaying that. But we've seen lots of people with flu. You feel awful. You feel horrible. Most of the time, when you look at the numbers, most of the time you recover from it and you go back to doing your thing. When you contrast it with rabies, if you get rabies and you're getting symptoms, you're dead. It's 100% fatal at that point. So when you're balancing this one, you get sick and feel awful. Risk of dying is relatively low. This one, you get it and you die. So when you look at risks and benefits, then that's a no-brainer to me. Now, with rabies, relatively low incidence. In other words, I mean, how many people get bit by stray dogs, you know, in the middle?
Sure.
That doesn't happen very often. Not that you can 100% control for that, but you can reduce your risk. With flu, it just is what it is. I mean, you can lock yourself in your house and not see anybody, but nobody does that except for hermits. You can't control for how you get the flu. It's just one of those things that you can certainly do things like wash your hands and, you know, protect your mouth when you cough and, you know, not be around other people that are coughing and sneezing and those kinds of things. But you can't 100% control for that. The issue is if you get rabies, you're dead. If you get the flu, you're probably not. So it's a risk benefit thing. The second thing is when you look at certain immunizations, they are extremely powerful. You know, with smallpox, arguably the first vaccine that like prevents you from getting smallpox. In fact, we've effectively eradicated smallpox disease through vaccination principles. And, you know, the World Health Organization declared it eradicated. And although we still have some in the labs, but that vaccine worked. You get rabies, you get the rabies vaccine. That vaccine works. The flu shot doesn't work. That's from the CDC. That's from the FDA. That's from, you know, all of these different organizations and people since its inception in the 1940s. And when you look at the most recent systematic reviews, there's not significant evidence that it works. Now, some will say the flu shot absolutely works. Now, there's a difference between effectiveness and efficacy.
What's the difference?
So efficacy means that when I give you an immunization, that your body develops antibodies against that antigen. The antigen would be what would cause the disease, or at least associated with it. So if you get the flu shot, it is efficacious. It does cause your body to make antibodies against it. The problem is that it is not effective. It has not been shown to be effective in reducing the incidence of the flu. And that has been in study after study. There are some studies that will show it, but you know, like this one, let me go back one page, like the one that says in 1995 when the FDA acknowledged the ongoing paucity of randomized trials and warned about serious methodologic flaws in many existing flu vaccine studies. When you review the, when you read the Cochrane reviews in 2010, 2012 on the flu shot, there is, they talk directly about the funding, the influence of the industry, you know, who paid for the study, how did they conduct the study, and the results that they got. But when you look at it objectively, it, there is clearly a bias in the studies that are conducted on the flu shot. And when you remove that bias, there's not good evidence that it works.
So then why are, I feel like the overwhelming message that I'm still receiving is go get your flu shot more than don't go get a flu shot or get the nasal spray. Why are we still seeing or hearing that then?
Well, I think there's a, I think there's a couple of things. Number one, I think there's the possibility, and I'm, again, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I think there's the possibility of lobbying, you know, with governmental influence. You know, you get the ACIP is a panel, and I believe there were 16 members, 14 that voted in favor of making this recommendation to not use the shot, or I'm sorry, the nasal spray, and then two that did not vote again. One abstained, and one had some other issue. May have been conflict of interest or something like that. But there's the potential for influence on these panel members. And I'm not saying that they were influenced. I don't know that. But there's always that question. So is the pharmaceutical industry or the manufacturers of these flu shots influencing these physicians? And most physicians would say, no, I'm not influenced by that. And study after study shows that it does make a difference. It does change the physician's mindset about prescribing habits.
And when you talk about the influence, you know, what kind of magnitude? You said 171 million vaccinations, or
that's what they anticipate for the coming year.
Yeah. So 171 million times how much is the average flu shot or nasal spray?
I don't know what the cost is on it. I mean, most places you can probably get it for $15 or something like that.
Okay,
so you're probably talking, I don't know, $4 or $5. Maybe a couple of dollars for the actual cost of the vaccine itself.
Cost of it, $4 or $5, but charging, you know, $15 a pop. So that's $1 billion. That's $1 billion a season, you know, thing that,
right.
And so that's pretty significant.
Exactly. So, and that raises the next piece, which is why would they make the recommendation to stop the nose spray, but they've never made a recommendation to not use the flu shot. And interestingly, in the recommendation, they talk about this very thing, that the nose spray only accounts for 8% of the 171 to 176 million doses of influenza protection for the next year. So they're looking at the data and they're saying, well, this doesn't work. But, and I'm not saying that they consciously thought this, but there's, okay, well, this doesn't work. And I mean, if you just don't even look at the other stuff, then it won't come to light. But the other piece of that is looking at efficacy versus effectiveness. And if you go to revolutionhealth.org and search in the search bar on the website for flu, one of them is like all you need to know about the flu shot. And I post on in that article, there is a package insert or a portion of a package insert from one of the flu shots called Flulaval. And in it, it says exactly that the recommendations for this shot are based on efficacy, and it has not been shown or has not been proven to prevent flu. Says it right there in the handout. So it goes back to that efficacy versus effectiveness. And so you have to be very careful about interpreting the data. And are they talking about the ability of the body to make antibodies, or are they talking about preventing flu? I would argue that no one really cares if you have antibodies if it doesn't prevent the flu. So when you look at the epidemiologic data for the last 50 years, where's the evidence that it makes a difference? The Cochrane reviews don't show it. The statistically or historically, it doesn't show it. So we've got something that hasn't been shown to be effective, and now they're coming out and saying, don't use the nose spray because it doesn't work. But these others do, but are they looking at efficacy or effectiveness? And I didn't get a chance to read those actual reports myself.
This is serious.
I agree.
This is serious. So come in full circle. The nasal spray finally has been recommended that it is not working. Let's cancel that. It's not been shown to be effective.
Right.
But when you look at the data, none of it's been shown to be effective.
Correct.
Okay. So this is a big deal. And so for all the listeners out there, in terms of like next steps for them, you can read more about everything that you need to know about the flu, revolutionhealth.org.
Right.
What would you say for this upcoming season, in terms of whether they're deciding or to get the flu shot or not?
Well, you got to remember that many people don't have a choice. If you work in a hospital, they almost threaten your life with, you have to get the flu shot. Mm. And again, this is, it's barbaric tactics for, based on no sound evidence. And some people say that, well, in fact, I've heard this, that you got to get your flu shot so that you don't transmit it to your patients. That was actually studied and it was shown that it doesn't work. Mm. And yet it's still, we had these recommendations.
Sure.
So what do I recommend? I've got a couple of posts on the website where I talk about what to do to prevent the flu itself and what can you do to treat the flu itself. But then I also talk about what do you do if you have to get the flu shot and, you know, how to manage that. And we'll have those as podcasts coming up soon. We're not quite in the flu season, but as we get closer, we'll start having more stuff about that.
Dr. Edwards, thank you so much for sharing this today. The grass is green, sky is blue. Studies show the flu shot doesn't work.
That's right. And you have to pay your taxes.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast with Dr. Chad Edwards. Tune in next week where we'll be going against the grain.